in front of them all. He wondered why Bridget had chosen that moment. He looked to his mother, hoped she hadn't noticed. John said,
"Have you heard the one about the cloistered nun who took a vow of silence?"
"Yes," Bridget said, her tone discouraging. It was an old, bad joke of their father's. But John went on, undaunted.
"She was allowed to say only two words once every 5 years. After the first five, she said, 'Bed hard.' After 10, she said, 'Food bad.' After 15, 'Room cold.' On her 20th anniversary at the convent, she announced to the Mother Superior that she wanted to go home. The Mother Superior replied, 'Good riddance. You've done nothing but complain since you got here.'"
They laughed, even though it wasn't funny. John, with that heaving sound he made as if he were coughing something up. For a long time, John had this voice he'd put on for work. Serious, kind of schlocky, deeper than he was naturally inclined to be. The family made fun of him for it until Patrick pointed out that John now spoke in that voice all the time. There were only rare glimpses of the old him, but he had appeared here tonight. Bridget and John went on for a while, trying to top each other's bad jokes.
"Three-legged dog walks into a saloon," Bridget said. "He hobbles up to the bartender and says, 'I'm looking for the man who shot my paw.'"
The two of them erupted in laughter.
"How many Republicans does it take to change a light bulb?" she said.
John raised up his hands.
"Nope, not going down that path with you tonight."
"Oh, come on." As he often did when he was small, Brian sat listening, not adding anything, no real stake in it, content to follow the sound of their voices. In a family where everyone had been fighting to get a word in since before you were born, you could jump into the fray or step back and let the rest of them do the talking. Bridget and John, as different as they were, still shared an ease with each other that stretched back to the early days, something Brian didn't have with either one of them. Only with Patrick. He wondered if all families were like this, divided into teams. When he was born, Bridget and John were 10 and 11. They were often left in charge of him, which made them eager to escape him the rest of the time. Patrick carried Brian around on his shoulders. He took him to the beach, just the two of them. When Patrick moved back to Dorchester, Brian was 5. The distance only served to make Brian idolize him more. The big thrill of his week was Sunday afternoon, when Pat came to dinner and paid him to sit by the TV and turn the dial, giving him a quarter each time he changed the channel from one football game to another. Brian was the outsider when alone with John and Bridget. In a room with just the two of them, he was always waiting for Patrick to come in and even the score. That would never happen again. Bridget reached for a plate of sliced soda bread. The plate was covered in green plastic wrap, the holiday kind, pulled tight, one sheet over the next, over the next, over the next. Bridget didn't even try to unwrap it, just jammed her thumb straight through all those layers and pulled out a piece. There was always so much soda bread at these things, dry and bland, dense and white, choking you when you took a bite, which you would anyway, hoping somehow they had found a way to improve the stuff since the last time you tried it. Bridget bit off one small corner, then put the rest down on the table. "What else is there?" She tried the fridge, pulled out a baking dish, chicken parmesan. She ate it cold, standing up, straight from the pan.
"Are those two trays with the clear plastic lids still in there?"
John said.
"Yep." "Can you do me a favor and eat one of those instead so Julia won't be pissed in the morning?"
"What are they?"
One's brie with dates, and the other is shrimp shumai.
What the hell is that?
Dumplings.
Bridget made a face.
No can do, my friend.
Fine, give me the dumplings.
She handed him the tray, and John sucked down five of the things.
You like your dumplings, Bridget said.
I like keeping the peace.
Bridget took a can of Bud Light from the cooler for each of them and set them down. The ice had melted. The cooler was a tub of water now. The cans dripped onto the table. Nora would have rushed to clean it up, but Bridget didn't even seem to notice.
What's up with your girlfriend?
John asked. For a second, Brian thought he was asking Bridget, but John was looking at him.
She's not my girlfriend, Brian said.
I like her, Bridget said. She's nice.
She's cute, John said. How old is she?
27, I think.
You're 33. You're going to have to settle down eventually. I know this is a family of late bloomers, but...
Speaking of, Bridget said, I have an announcement. Natalie and I are going to have a baby. She was trying to sound breezy, light, but Brian could tell it was a big deal for her, saying those words. He felt stunned. He had never considered the possibility.
Holy shit. Natalie's pregnant, John said.
No, she's going to be. Soon.
So she's planning a pregnancy.
Yes, John. Gay women don't tend to get pregnant by accident.
Will you get married?
I don't think so. I don't know.
When are you going to tell Mom?
Soon. Definitely by the time the kid is in high school. She sighed. I'm planning to tell her before we leave.
Wow.
Yeah, but don't get too excited. I've already tried twice and failed. You two were my practice round. It didn't go so bad, right? Now, to get my mind off of that terrifying prospect, can we please go back to the nun? I don't remember ever going to a convent when we were kids. Do you, John?
No.
I wonder if... She put a hand over her mouth. Oh.
What?
I almost said, I wonder if Patrick remembers. How does Mom keep a secret like this from us all this time? We don't even know that woman, I swear.
She tried to guilt me about how siblings shouldn't be estranged. It isn't natural. Every time Pat and I stopped speaking, John said, how's that for hypocrisy?
Brian thought that maybe it had nothing to do with hypocrisy. Maybe it had cost their mother more than they knew, being apart from her sister for so long. Maybe she was just speaking from experience. It didn't bother him that his mother hadn't told them about her sister. The family was built on things that went unsaid. There might be hints, whispers from another room that fell to silence when he entered. There were stories he simply accepted that he didn't know the whole of, and others he didn't even know he didn't know the whole of. Who wanted to know everything about his own mother? He thought about the girls he'd hung around with in college and the ones he met in his baseball days, dropping F-bombs, wearing red thongs that stuck out above their jeans, having threesomes and then joking about it later. Lots of them were mothers now. Could their children sense it on them, this past that was anything but motherly? He wondered what Bridget meant to get out of possessing every fact. It would never answer the questions of how or why the worst things happened. She had said they didn't know their mother. Brian knew the shape and color of Nora's underthings hanging on the drying rack in the laundry room. He knew exactly how much milk to add to her red rose tea in the morning, the precise shade of the liquid, still dark, with a hint of sunset pink. Not too cloudy, or she'd sigh. He knew that every December, when White Christmas came on television, she'd say that Holiday Inn was far superior to this bit of treacle. But then she'd keep watching, forget herself, and sing along. She loved gory paperback thrillers. He had once picked up the book his mother was in the middle of, turned to a random page, and found himself reading the details of a horrific rape. Shocking to think that that's how this sweet, smiling lady spent her downtime. Though he supposed it was what everyone did. They read about murder and rape and scandal, or else they watched it on TV, to distract themselves from whatever was wrong with their own lives. He knew that his mother was a bigger Red Sox fan than any of the guys he had grown up with, the kind who preferred to watch the games at home alone. When John and Julia threw a party for a Saturday game, Nora would go along, make the pasta salad and the brownies, but she got irritated when people talked over the announcers. She didn't like anyone to see how much it mattered to her, how she kneaded her hands together until they were red, how she said Hail Marys under her breath. She believed in ridiculous superstitions. Once David Ortiz hit a home run in the eighth inning while Brian was standing in the doorway to the den, saying goodbye to her before he left for work. She commanded him not to move from that spot until the game was over. He didn't need to know any more than that. And he would never go looking.
They said on the weather that it might snow in the morning, John said.
Brian remembered something, and for once he said it out loud, as a defense of Nora, maybe. He wanted to remind them of what was good in her.
Did Mom stay up late with you guys listening to the school cancellations when you were kids? He said.
I remember, sitting right here, and she'd make hot chocolate, and the two of us would both pray out loud for the word Hull to get mentioned. When it did, that meant movies on the VCR and pancakes in the morning.
Bridget looked at him, and then at John, who shook his head laughing.
Sometimes I swear you were raised by another mother than we were, she said. John nodded.
A mother who actually liked you.
They ran out of beer by three.
There's Bailey's and whiskey and gin in the liquor cabinet, Brian said.
Bridget said, Liquor before beer, you're in the clear. Beer before liquor, never been sicker. Words of wisdom from the old man. Don't say he never taught us anything. She was already getting up to retrieve the whiskey.
I wish it wasn't too late to order a pizza, John said.
The fridge is full of food, Bridget said.
I hate all those sympathy casseroles, that shake and bake shit.
Well, there's always Julia's brie.
I hate that shit even more.
Bridget poured them each a drink.
He seems to have a little less stick up his ass than usual, she said to Brian, nodding toward John.
Maybe that's Patrick working his magic from the other side.
Maybe so, John said. Or maybe it's the 47 drinks I've had.
The other side. Brian wondered in earnest where Patrick was. He knew his mother believed in heaven, thought of it as an actual physical place in the sky.
Slantcha, they said, to Patrick.
The clear, simple sound of their glasses clinking together stirred something in Brian. It was a thread connecting every wedding and wake and celebration of his life. Patrick there for all of it.
I want to say something, Bridget said, clearing her throat. Just once. I know neither of you will want to hear it, and I'd never say it to Mom. But do you think he did it on purpose?
No, Brian said. She went on as if she hadn't heard him.
Let's face it, Pat drove better drunk than sober.
Absolutely not, Brian said, louder this time. He added, he had tickets to the Beanpot next month,
as if this proved something. Bridget wasn't the first to say it. It had come up at the bar last night. He and Fergie were both quick to shut down even the suggestion. That wasn't Patrick. It just wasn't.
Brian looked over at John. He was crying. He didn't think he'd ever seen John cry before.
I wasn't going to say anything, but I think I know what happened, John said. Do you want to know about it?
Of course, Bridget said. Tell us.
Brian felt nervous. He wasn't at all sure he wanted to know. When someone in the family died, they learned more about that person than they ever had before. It seemed unfair, since the dead were no longer there to answer for what they'd done. He didn't want to put Patrick in that position.
It was my fault, John said.
How could it be your fault? Bridget said gently. You can't blame yourself because you two weren't getting along. That's not enough to...
No. Wait. Listen to me. There was this article in the Globe on Sunday.
Brian froze. He knew what John was about to say.
Rory McLean helped this kid he knew from Dorchester. A total mess, caught up in heroin and all that. The guy went blind in high school. He got attacked. Rory always felt bad for him. So Rory calls me today, and he says Patrick is the one who did it. The one who blinded the kid. There was some kind of fight.
Do you believe that?
That he blinded someone and we never knew? Bridget said.
No.
No, Brian repeated, relieved that that had been her answer. But he was thinking of the way Pat had acted at the bar on Sunday when the article came up.
Bridget, it was right before we moved here, John said. You remember how strange that all was?
He wiped tears from his eyes.
Rory seemed to think the article might have set something off in Pat. And I'm the reason it was there in the first place. I pushed them to run it. I begged. I'm not saying he did it on purpose, but maybe that's why he drank so much that night. Or maybe he always drank that much, but it had him distracted and he missed something on the road, swerved just a second too late.
Bridget shook her head. Brian could tell she was concerned for John now, most of all. She looked to him.
Did Pat say anything about this article?
Their eyes were on Brian, John's so full of hope.
No, Brian said. He only ever read the Herald.
The color came back into John's face.
Thank God, he said.
He put his head on the table.
Was it true, what Rory McLean had said?
Brian didn't want to believe it. He decided on the spot that he wouldn't. He didn't. They might never know what happened. They would each go forward seeing it in their own ways, just as they did with all the other secrets they had chosen to share or not share with one another. He hoped Patrick had just been so drunk that he drifted off to sleep, and that, despite what happened, he had somehow managed to never wake up.
"I'd better go to bed," John said. "I need to get up early and finish the eulogy."
He swallowed his drink and stood, throwing his head back.
"I'm drunk," he said. He sounded genuinely surprised.
John stumbled out, and then upstairs. Brian and Bridget watched him go. Bridget pushed her chair back.
"I'm gonna head up too, kiddo. I've gotta buy something online."
"For the shelter?" he said.
"Nah."
She looked like she was about to say more, and then thought better of it.
"You should come up soon yourself," she said.
"I will." She paused in the doorway.
"Did you see how the nun touched his hair?" she asked, more to herself than to him.
Rocco followed her from the room. After she had gone, Brian sat alone. His glass was empty, but for a half moon of brown liquid clinging to the bottom edge. He knew he shouldn't have any more, that if he did, he'd be unbearably hungover in the morning. But he poured himself one last small glass of Jameson. Maybe it wasn't fair to compare, but he thought he missed Patrick more than his brother and sister did. He and Nora had loved Patrick the most. The other two had families, lives. Bridget would have a baby soon. He wondered if this would make his mother happy. Brian had built his life around Patrick. What would he do now? Who would he become? He downed the whiskey in one swallow, then poured a tiny bit more. After the wake, Julia and Maeve had gathered all the framed photographs and put them in a box. Brian got to his feet and found it in the hall. He took the frame on the top of the pile. Patrick's school photo, 5th or 6th grade. Brian carried it up to his room. He turned on the light, stood in front of the mirror. His reflection looked troublingly normal. One of Nora's favorite sayings was, "What would you have today if you woke up with only the things you thanked God for yesterday?" He wondered now if this had been a warning that he was too foolish to grasp. Patrick had said that when he died, he wanted to be cremated, his ashes tossed into Boston Harbor from the back of a sailboat. Nora wouldn't allow it. She said real Catholics didn't get cremated. Brian had to stop himself from asking why she thought of Patrick as a real Catholic. But then, he was grateful, too, that he would know where to find his brother. Patrick would be buried tomorrow in the plot where their father lay. Would Brian visit him the way his mother visited the dead, as if she were going to meet them for lunch? She swept the gravestones and left flowers and talked to the people lying beneath her feet. He thought he understood this now. It was amazing that you did not become your grief entirely and walk around leaking it everywhere. It could lie dormant inside you for days, weeks, years. You could seem a perfectly whole person to everyone you met. Without warning, grief might poke you in the ribs, punch you in the gut, knock the wind out of you. But even then, you seemed just fine. The world went on and on. Part 8, 2009. Chapter 22. Bridget reached out in the darkness, fumbled for the lamp. Her hand slammed against a wall. Objects in the room came into focus. Slowly, she remembered that she was home at her mother's house. They would bury her brother today. Natalie was asleep beside her, the pair of them crammed onto a twin mattress. Bridget stretched her neck, her lower back. The time spent in her childhood bed had left her sore. The booze hadn't helped. She felt like she had been hit between the eyes with a hammer. A thick, mossy taste hung in her mouth. The sheets were flannel, a red and black plaid, pilled from wear. She had kicked them off in the night. They were too warm. Sheets for the season, which, along with all the others in the house, would be replaced by a light cotton set in spring, even without the promise of anyone to fill the beds. Only faith on her mother's part that something, soon enough, would lead them all back again. Bridget looked up at the ceiling and then at the clock. It was just after 7. She had only gone to bed 4 hours ago. She considered going back to sleep, but the dog, hearing her move about, began to whine. She sat up, put her feet on the floor. "All right," she said, "a quick one." She stood and pulled a sweatshirt and jeans from the floor, then her coat, which hung on the top corner of the closet door. At first, she didn't want to wake Natalie, but she was too excited to wait. Bridget kissed her cheek, and when Natalie moaned in protest, she whispered, "I got you a present." Natalie smiled. She extended her hands without opening her eyes. "I didn't wrap it," Bridget said, "though in my defense, it's almost 6 feet tall, 175 pounds. Natalie was suddenly wide awake. "You bought the international archaeologist?"
"The full supply."
"So we're doing this," Natalie said.
"We're doing it."
They kissed and they hugged, and then Bridget told her to get some sleep. She and Rocco left the room. She closed the door gently behind her. After her mother threw everyone out last night, Bridget had followed her upstairs. She knocked at Nora's bedroom.
"It's me," she said when Nora didn't respond. "Can I come in?"
Again, there was only silence. She opened the door anyway and found her mother sitting on the edge of the bed, staring down at her hands in her lap.
"Do you want anything?" Bridget said. "A glass of water? A shot of tequila?"
She meant the last part as a joke, but Nora just looked at her as if trying to recall who she was.
"Would you get me another box of tissues?" she said finally. "In the linen closet in the hall."
"Sure, of course." Bridget went to it, opened the door. Her mother had 17 bars of ivory soap, 10 red boxes of Colgate in 2 neat stacks, an unopened 12-pack of toilet paper. When something went on sale, Nora bought 10. Usually, when Bridget visited, she would ask right away, "Do you need Ziploc bags? Do you need toothpaste?" In her entire life, she had never run out of anything. It was an accomplishment. 3 boxes of Kleenex sat beside a tiny white cube, shrink-wrapped. Bridget recognized it as something Julia had given her mother for Christmas 2 or 3 years ago. When she unwrapped it, Nora made no expression.
"That's great stuff," Julia had said. "Creme de la mer. Movie stars swear by it."
$85 for half an ounce," John said.
I'm pretty sure heroin is cheaper.
It's a splurge, Julia said, shooting him a look. Every woman deserves one of those now and then. Nora held the box out to her. You should return this. Buy something for yourself.
Don't be silly, Julia said. Enjoy it.
It's a waste of money. I'll never use it, Nora said.
Apparently, she had remained faithful to her word and carried on rubbing Vaseline into her dry cheeks and forehead on principle. Bridget returned to her mother's room. Nora had gotten under the covers, turned off the light. Bridget didn't think she was crying. Her mother wouldn't, in front of anyone. The request for Kleenex was startling enough.
Do you want to talk?
I just want to sleep, Nora said. She sounded like a terrified child.
If you want to talk about any of it, Mom, I'm here, okay?
All right. Bridget squeezed her hand. As she turned to leave, Nora called out her name.
Yes?
Bridget wondered if this was the moment when her mother would say that she knew, that she loved her, or maybe Nora wanted her to confess the truth. Before she could give it another moment's thought, Nora said softly,
I can hear them loading the dishwasher down there. Please just make sure they know to clean the good china by hand.
The house was still. The only sounds were the sounds of mourning beginning outside. Bridget went into the hall, surprised to find her mother's bedroom door shut. Nora was usually up by now, the coffee made, bacon sputtering in a frying pan. Bridget was happy she was still asleep, that she was able to sleep at all. On her way to the stairs, she passed John's old room, the door ajar. John and Maeve and Julia were crowded onto an air mattress that covered the entire floor. The single bed was neatly made, a Larry Bird poster hanging above it, a plain wooden cross on the opposite wall. In the dresser there were probably socks that had lost their form, and T-shirts, maybe an old pair of jeans, things John no longer wanted, but would never throw away because there was no need to. This house would hold their pasts as long as Nora was in it. She had never thought to turn their bedrooms into a study or a guest room, but had instead left them perfectly preserved, just as they'd been when they moved away. Their rooms were like the rooms of the dead, monuments to another time. Bridget looked into Brian's room. The smell of cologne hovered in the air, only partly covering the stink of dirty laundry. A dartboard hung on the wall. Grade school trophies and bobbleheads of Red Sox past lined the windowsills. He had not transformed the space with age, only added to what was already there, a queen-sized bed instead of a single, but with the same old camouflage comforter, a big screen TV on the bureau, wedged between a CD player and boxes of baseball cards in plastic sleeves. The room was meant for a child and could barely contain all this. It was as if Brian's life had unfolded on itself and he was lost in the middle somewhere. On the far wall there was a small Indian's pennant. The top corner flopped over in a way that depressed her. Her mother still had Indians-themed potholders in a drawer downstairs, an Indians bottle opener. There was a stack of 10 or 15 ball caps in the cellar, which her parents used to buy and give out to anyone who came over, as if they'd gotten them for free. "Our son is on the team," they'd brag to the cable guy or the man who came to check the gas meter. Bridget wondered if it caused Brian pain having to see these objects again and again. It was so easy to get mired in the past if you didn't yank yourself out for dear life. Nora had liked them best, Bridget thought, when they were children. She imagined Nora, after they had gone, walking up the steep staircase to Patrick's room in the attic, facing what remained of him there. Bridget went downstairs. She put on a hat, coat, and gloves. Still, when she opened the door, the cold hit her like an object, something solid and hard. There was a sharp, crisp scent to the air. Her mother would have said it smelled like snow. Nora's car wasn't in the driveway. She wondered where her mother would have gone at this hour. To the church, maybe. Or to Odell's, which wouldn't be open yet. Just to be close to him. She led the dog down the hill, past all the familiar houses of her childhood. She followed the curve of the street until she reached the bottom, where the houses sat right on the water. Betty Joyce's house was dark. At Eileen Delaney's, just the kitchen light was on. As she walked, she thought of her mother and of the sister Nora had never mentioned before yesterday. Now, at her worst moment, Nora wanted her back. Or some part of her did, anyway. Bridget thought of her family in terms of what they didn't know about her. She had rarely wondered about the mysteries they harbored. How could you be this close, be a family, and yet be so unknown to one another? When she was young, it felt as if Patrick and John each commanded so much attention in his way that she was an afterthought. She dated a girl once who said this was why Bridget had gone to New York, to be seen as something other than herself in relation to the rest of them. That stayed with her. It was true. Moving to New York had saved her life. But sometimes it felt like a kind of exile. In her heart, she believed that she belonged here, among her family, in the only place she had ever thought of as home. In her work, she saw such cruelty and injustice. She saw that people could be truly awful. But for all the sadness and the head-scratching, there was goodness to balance it out. A guy came in once with a Saint Bernard he'd found tied up, abandoned. The dog had a prong collar embedded in her neck. The guy came by and walked the dog every Saturday. After a couple of months, he told Bridget he was moving away the next weekend and wouldn't be back. He said a tearful goodbye to the Saint Bernard. But when Saturday morning came, there he was, rolling up in a U-Haul. "I couldn't leave without her," he said. "I think she'll like Virginia." The main drag was empty. Out of habit, she waited for the light to change, then crossed over the road and into the public parking lot of Nantasket Beach. She arrived at the seawall and let the dog pull her down the stairs to the sand. It was low tide, no one else in sight. Bridget let Rocco off his leash. He ran to the surf, chasing it in and out like a puppy. She pulled a ball from her pocket and tossed it into the waves. There were flurries in the air. She missed Patrick. His sweetness. His craziness. The family looked different to her now. When one of them vanished, those who remained were transformed into something new. This happened again and again, and would keep happening, despite however much they might wish it wouldn't. But to her surprise, she felt a burst of joy, of hope, in spite of it. Natalie's influence, she supposed. Her faith that love was everything in the end, even if it was an imperfect love, a love that depended on memory, on some former version of who they were. Natalie believed that if they let her, Nora would surprise them. Maybe there was no reason not to wish for it. Bridget looked out at the water, the land on the other side too far away to see. She said a silent prayer for the departed and for the ones who were yet to come. Chapter 23. 2 hours earlier, 5:30 in the morning, Nora was lying in bed, mind ravaged, thinking of what she had done. She had been up all night, on and off, thrashing in the sheets, bolting upright, awake, and at the same time, unsure of whether she had yet gone to sleep. John had driven her home from the wake the night before. As they turned out of Odell's parking lot, she saw her sister at the corner getting into a taxi. Teresa looked so alone. Nora felt something unhinge in her. She was cruel, terrible. Still, she didn't do a thing to make it right. She turned to Maeve in the back seat and asked if she was hungry for lasagna. At the house, full of people, she thought only of the ones who were absent. Charlie, her Patrick, whom all the wishing in the world could never conjure now, and Teresa. Nora realized it, standing at the stove, and the presence of everyone else became unbearable. Voices from other rooms were an invasion. They didn't care. Not enough. She sent them away. Embarrassing to think about it now, but it had felt beyond her control. In bed at first, Nora had a strong sense that her sister had deserved the harsh treatment. Teresa could come to the funeral if she liked. They didn't have to speak. But Nora couldn't stick to her anger. Her thoughts kept wandering in another direction. She wondered why she had made that call in the first place. She thought it was a punishment at the time, not about her at all. But perhaps her better angels had somehow known she needed Teresa here. She had never believed that Teresa loved Patrick, not the way she did. But standing over his body with Teresa, Nora felt it, her sister's grief as palpable as her own. For some reason, she thought of Maeve in that moment, how the orphanage said someone had left her wrapped in a pink blanket in a crowded market where she would easily be found. Diapers and coins sprinkled around her as offerings, symbols of a mother's love, her devotion. Nora thought of Teresa running from the house that final night, leaving Patrick to her care. She thought of the medal that arrived in the mail 17 years later, with him when he was born, and when he was laid to rest. At 6, she dressed and went downstairs, expecting to find a mess. She would have 50 people here later. There was so much work to be done. When Charlie died, she could not bring herself to make dessert. It was simply one step more than she could manage. So she cheated and went to a fancy bakery in Hingham and bought brownies and lemon squares, just that once. When they asked in complimentary tones, "Did you make these yourself?" she sputtered, "Of course." Last night she had gone much further. She had let them all see the worst of her. Now, at the foot of the stairs, peering into the living room, Nora found, with some degree of amazement, that her children had cleaned to perfection. As she neared the kitchen, she could hear a foot tapping on the floor. She wondered if it was Patrick. And then she wondered how much longer her mind would play this trick, not entirely unwelcome. John sat there, elbows on the table, hands in his hair, a notepad in front of him.
"You're working today?"
"No," he said. "It's the eulogy."
"Oh."
He had made coffee. She poured herself a cup.
"Did you sleep?" he said.
"Not much." John wrote something down on the page and then looked up at her.
"Did you see that article in the paper on Sunday? The one about Rory?"
"Yes," she said. "Nice photograph."
"But did you read it?"
"No, I got busy with other things. I'm sorry."
"There was a kid called O'Shea, a blind kid. Do you know who I'm talking about?"
Peter O'Shea. Nora had prayed for him every night since the first time she heard his name. She looked John in the eye.
"Yes."
"You were right, you know," John said. "I should have found a way. We had our differences. But we were brothers."
She knew his list of grievances. The money, Maeve's confirmation, how Patrick had stopped him from going to St. Ignatius. She had wondered why Patrick hadn't just told John the truth about the school. That right or wrong, it was for John's own protection that he had done what he did. Maybe she ought to have told John herself. Someone could save your life without you ever knowing it. It happened more than most people realized.
"I should have found a way."
"It's not easy," she said.
"I know that as well as anyone."
John looked surprised.
"Yeah," he said. "Right. Of course."
"You should get some more sleep, John. You look so tired."
"I am."
"Go on, then. I need to run out. I'll be back soon." He looked at the clock.
"Now?"
"Yes."
"Do you want me to come?"
"No, thank you. Go upstairs to your family. I'll wake you when I'm back." She was in the car by 6:15, in Dorchester a half hour later. The old neighborhood had changed so much. She wondered if Teresa would even recognize it. Nowadays, Edison Green had a tall brick senior center right in the middle. No more grass. No more boys playing ball. Mrs. Quinlan's house and all the others around it were full of Vietnamese people. The Irish had mostly moved on. The dance halls had closed long ago. Dorchester had always been Patrick's favorite. So many other young people wanted to get away. He had come back, opened the bar here of all places. He was the most loyal person she had ever known. Had he been there to see his best friend stumbling drunk into his own wake, Patrick would have found a way to excuse it. She thought of how much Teresa had loved Dorchester, too, when they were young. She thought even further back than that. To home. Nora had told the children they couldn't afford to go to Ireland, which was partly true. But the whole of it was, she didn't want to go. She thought she would die without ever seeing home again. John had been so proud when he surprised them with a trip. She could hardly say no. He flew the whole family over. Nora and Charlie sat in first class. She had kept the little bottles of champagne they handed out. She still had them, at the back of a kitchen cabinet. She was so afraid that someone in town would slip. In advance of the trip, and even on the plane, she thought of just telling the children the truth. "I have a sister. We haven't spoken in years." But she didn't do it. Time ran out. Naturally, after a long flight to Shannon and an early morning drive, bleary-eyed and on the wrong side of the road, the first person the family ran into on the high street in Milltown Malby was a girl Nora knew from school.
"How's Teresa doing?"
was the first thing out of her mouth. Nora startled, but then she saw that her children hadn't thought anything of it. They knew 24 Teresas back home. It horrified her to find the old house in shambles, as if it had never meant a thing to anyone. She supposed this was why she never threw anything away. It mattered, having something you could claim as your own. When she and Teresa stopped speaking, their brother kept them apprised of each other. But after he died, there was silence. Charlie's brother and his wife organized Martin's small funeral. Nora didn't go back for it. Brian was only 3 years old then. On the family trip to Ireland, when her brother's name was mentioned, they expected her unending thanks for what they had done. They had not even bought him a proper headstone, only a flat granite marker. While Nora was busy giving their people a king's send-off on the other side of the ocean. She stood before her family's graves for a long while, her children beside her, unable to fathom what she had lost. She thought of how hurt she had felt when Bridget moved to New York. No one else in the family had children who went away like that. She herself had gone so much farther, never returned until now. It wasn't right that you could only understand your parents' pain once you'd experienced the things they had. And by then, in her case anyway, they were gone. Milltown Malby was a different place than the one she left. Cars lined every sidewalk downtown, just like in Boston. The dance hall where Charlie first kissed her was a furniture store with rows of sofas and armchairs filling the once wide and empty floor. He spun her for a turn anyway, landing them both in a recliner, a memory she would hold for the rest of her life. She had never seen the sweeping cliffs of Moher before, 20 minutes from where they grew up. When she went there with the children, Nora saw how beautiful the cliffs were, how majestic. John read aloud from a guidebook about the stone walls, miles of them, laid by hand thousands of years ago. He wanted to tell her the story of her own life. There was a plaque now, not far from the house where she grew up, commemorating the site of the Renin ambush of 1920. It told of the blood in the streets, the children killed, the homes burned. Her own father would have been 10 years old then. He had never mentioned it. Had it been too painful to say out loud, or had he spared his children the knowledge, as Nora spared hers in her way? Nora met up with her old friend Una Donnelly for tea. Over the years, their letters had dwindled down to a yearly Christmas card. Una seemed happy. She was plump now, with silver hair. She looked much older than Nora did, or so Nora wanted to believe. She had 7 grandchildren already. Their photographs covered every inch of her refrigerator. Una said 3 of them were being raised in Stockholm by their father, her son, and the Swedish woman he had fallen in love with at university, but never felt the need to marry. The rest lived just down the road. All Una's grandkids were sent to the Gaeltacht on Inishmore in summertime to learn their history. They spoke perfect Irish. Nora was at once envious of her and embarrassed for her. There was something depressing about that country kitchen with its dim lighting, the folding chairs, a collection of porcelain cats on the windowsill. The countertops were crowded with cookbooks and circulars, newspapers and half-empty soda bottles, pans in a precarious pile. Nora felt an urge to put everything back where it belonged. There was a small television, which Una kept switched on even as they talked, glancing over at the set from time to time. Before they parted, Una asked after her sister. Nora had written to her about Teresa becoming a nun and about their falling out, but she had never told Una about Patrick. It was too difficult to explain in a letter. The thought of putting it down on paper seemed too great a risk. Sitting there in Una's kitchen, Nora considered telling her, but she only said, "We don't talk anymore. She has her life and I have mine." She could see that the answer didn't quite satisfy Una, but she took it no further. The old Friel's pub had the name Lynch over the door now, but everyone, even the Lynches, still called it Friel's. When Nora left Una's house and found the others there, her children were in high spirits, proud of themselves for making the reunion possible. They thought having the chance to catch up over tea would delight her. They didn't think how it might stoke pain, bring back the memory of saying goodbye to Una. In all her years in America, Nora had never made such a friend. She turned onto Dorchester Avenue on purpose. She didn't have to go this way, but Nora wanted to see the bar, even closed, as it would certainly be at this hour. It was the place Patrick had last been himself, the place he had last been. There was nobody behind her. She slowed down as she came to the bar and saw flowers heaped at the curb. The sight of them made her cry. The grate was up, the door wide open. As she passed by, Nora could make out a figure sitting alone inside. "He made so many people so happy," Brian's girlfriend had said last night. She was not the woman Nora would have chosen for him. But none of them would ever end up with the person she'd imagined for them. Nora thought of Bridget, holding Natalie's hand, bringing her up in line with the family. The answer to a question she had never wanted to ask, even of herself. It was crushing in its way, and yet, life went on. She didn't want to be so terrified anymore. She turned onto Morrissey Boulevard. 2 minutes later, she pulled into the motel parking lot, eager to get Teresa away from this place. In the lobby, a boy of 19 or 20 stood behind a desk, staring down at his phone. He didn't look up when she came in. "Excuse me," she said. "I'm looking for someone, a guest." "I can't give you anyone's information, ma'am," he said, trying to sound stern, looking nervous. She realized he must think she was a scorned wife on the trail of a cheating husband. That was the sort they got around here. "She's my sister," Nora said, "a nun. I'm here to pick her up for a family funeral." "Oh," his face flooded with relief. "Up on the second floor, room 209. He looked back at his phone and then up again.
So she really is a nun?
Nora went to the elevator, her hand trembling as she pressed the button. Once on the second floor, she went to the door, took a deep breath,